Okay, so you know how sometimes in law school you hit these concepts that just seem super basic at first, but then when you really start to dig in, they get kind of like surprisingly tricky. That's what we're dealing with today. Intent,
Big
procedure, and like the whole minefield of what can make evidence disappear.
literally disappear from a case.
So like gone.
Gone.
You gave us two like really interesting scenarios,
That.
and we're gonna try and pull out the core ideas of transferred intent and then that whole exclusionary rule thing and the like really fine line between messing up procedurally and just like straight up violating the Constitution when it comes to evidence.
Right. Yeah. Because like every law student or young lawyer has that moment where they're like, wait, so if they didn't do X exactly by the book, does that mean it all gets thrown out?
Oh yeah, totally. And it's not always that simple.
Not even close.
All right, so to kick things off, we've got this case, Commonwealth v. Lyons.
Okay. Classic.
It's Pennsylvania, 1925,
Okay.
and it's just like a stark story. William Lyons gets into it with his wife, Lizzie Hawkins, and he tries to shoot her.
Oh, wow.
But he ends up killing a bystander, Rex Humphrey, who, like, he obviously did not mean to harm at all.
Right.
But here's the thing, Lyons gets convicted of first degree murder.
First degree murder.
So how does that happen? Like, what's the legal idea that makes that possible?
So the big thing here is this doctrine called transferred intent.
Transferred
It's like
intent.
this cornerstone of criminal law.
Okay.
And it boils down to this: you intend to do something criminal to one person,
Right.
but you end up hurting someone else. Your original bad intent, it like transfers over to that unintended victim.
Okay.
You know that phrase, intent follows the bullet?
Yeah.
That's basically it.
So in Lyons' case, he clearly meant to do something awful to his wife.
Right, this attempted murder or at least aggravated assault.
Serious felony, then.
And because what he did led directly to someone else's death, that initial bad intent, that's enough to prove malice.
Which is necessary for a murder conviction.
Exactly. Even though Humphrey wasn't the person he was aiming at.
So even though like literally his aim was off,
Right.
his mindset, his intent towards his wife,
That's what gets him convicted of murder.
that's heavy.
Yeah. It just shows you how the law really zeroes in on that initial criminal thought process.
Yeah, and how much weight that carries.
Absolutely.
Now, there was also this whole debate in the Lyons trial about some pretty intense evidence.
Oh, yeah. I remember reading about this.
They brought up past threats and even assaults that Lyons had allegedly made against his wife.
See, that's what I was talking about. Like, that kind of stuff feels like it could totally sway a jury, you know?
Against the defendant.
Right. Like,
Yeah.
regardless of what happened with Humphrey.
So why did the court allow that in?
Right. Well, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, they were very aware of that potential for prejudice.
With that kind of past bad acts evidence.
Exactly. But they said this stuff wasn't just about painting Lyons as a violent guy in general. It was about his motive and his intent, specifically when he fired the gun. It gave crucial context to his actions that night. And it really backed up the prosecution's argument that he meant to seriously hurt his wife.
Right.
This actually falls under a pretty well-established exception to the rule against prior bad acts.
Okay.
If the evidence directly proves something about the crime itself, like intent, motive, or opportunity, then it can be admissible.
So it wasn't just like throwing mud at Lyons with his past.
Right.
The court saw this direct connection between his previous behavior towards his wife
Yeah.
and his mental state when he shot the gun and killed the bystander.
That connection is key.
Okay. And then the defense also had issues with how the prosecution questioned Lyons specifically about his past arrests.
I wonder what they were trying to do there.
What was the court's take on that?
So that gets into this really interesting thing in law called opening the door.
Opening the
It
door.
basically means if one side brings up something in court,
Like a specific topic.
yeah, they're opening the door for the other side to bring up related stuff, even if it wouldn't normally be allowed.
Okay.
In this case, Lyons' lawyers, they were trying to make him look good, right?
Yeah.
Like suggesting he had good character.
Right.
So by doing that, they open the door for the prosecution to be like, hold on, let's look at his past.
Which included those arrests.
Exactly. The court looked at the actual questions the DA asked, and they said it was all fair game because it was directly responding to the defense's claims
Yeah.
about Lyons' character.
So not a mistrial?
Nope. The court said those questions weren't harmful or improper enough for that.
Okay, so to sum up the Lyons case, what are the big takeaways for our listeners?
All right, so number one, transferred intent,
Right.
meaning if you have criminal intent towards someone and you end up hurting someone else, you're still on the hook legally.
Your intent can make you responsible even if the outcome is different from what you planned.
Right. And Takeaway number two, evidence of past bad behavior is generally not allowed.
Right.
But it can be admitted if it directly proves important elements of the crime.
Like intent or motive.
Exactly. Especially if the defense tries to say the defendant has good character.
So be careful what you bring up in court, right?
You might be opening a door you don't want to open.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, let's move on to that second case you mentioned.
Yeah, the one from Massachusetts.
This one's more recent, and it's all about statutory violations.
Right.
Totally different situation here.
Good.
We've got a guy arrested for indecent exposure, mm-hmm. and this is important. This is completely separate from an assault that he was later identified in.
Okay, two different events.
During the indecent exposure arrest, they take his picture.
Standard procedure.
But they didn't follow a state law that required a pre-complaint hearing before doing that.
Oh, interesting.
And then that photograph is what leads to him being ID'd in the assault case.
Okay, so the big legal question is, does that photo and the ID that came from it, should that be thrown out because they messed up the procedure?
Suppressed.
Right, suppressed because of that statutory violation.
What did the court say?
The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court said, nope, the evidence stays
in.
And their reasoning is super important here.
Okay.
It boils down to this. The violation was of a state law, not a right protected by the U.S. Constitution or the Massachusetts Constitution.
So that's a big distinction.
Huge. The court made a point of saying that the initial arrest for indecent exposure was totally legal.
Probable cause.
Exactly.
Okay.
So there was no Fourth Amendment violation when they took the photo as part of that legal arrest.
So just because the police didn't dot every I and cross every T of this state law,
right,
that doesn't automatically mean the evidence they got is inadmissible in a completely different case.
Nope, and that's a crucial point for law students to grasp.
Because it's tempting to think that any procedural error is an automatic slam dunk for the defense.
The court was basically saying, hold on the exclusionary rule that's mainly for constitutional violations.
So that rule that keeps illegally obtained evidence out of court.
Yeah, that's a remedy for when your constitutional rights are violated.
So in this case, the state legislature made this rule about pre-complaint hearings. And the court's logic is that lawmakers probably didn't intend for every single little slip-up to mean automatic suppression, especially when no core constitutional right was violated.
It's about proportionality.
Right? Yeah, the remedy should fit the violation.
Exactly. And the court also looked at the purpose of the statute and whether suppressing the evidence would even achieve that purpose in this particular situation.
Makes sense. They're looking at the big picture.
They are.
Now, the summary also mentioned that the court considered what kind of evidence the photograph was calling it objective.
Right.
So how did that play into their decision?
So the court pointed out that a photograph, it's pretty much just a straight-up recording of what was there.
Okay.
Compared to something like a confession or even an eyewitness account, it's less likely to be influenced by bias or pressure or misinterpretation.
It's just the facts as they were visually.
Right. And that objectivity made them less inclined to suppress it.
Right. Because one of the main worries about illegally obtained evidence
is whether it's reliable.
Yeah, was someone's rights violated? Was the evidence itself maybe tampered with?
Exactly. But here you have an objective photograph taken after a procedural misstep, but not a constitutional violation.
So it's seen as more trustworthy inherently.
Right.
And what about the police officers themselves? Did the court look into whether they were intentionally trying to get around the rules to get this photo?
They did. And the court specifically said there was no evidence that the Bedford PD intentionally ignored that pre-complaint hearing rule.
To snag the photo for the assault case.
Exactly. They drew this really important distinction between negligence or just messing up the procedure versus intentionally trying to violate someone's rights.
Right. So like a good faith mistake versus bad faith.
Exactly. And they were saying negligence, while not great, it's not the same as purposely going around the law and violating someone's rights.
So the punishment or the remedy shouldn't be the same either.
Makes sense. The focus is on deterring those intentional violations of constitutional rights.
Okay, so bottom line for law students listening is this.
Hit me with it.
Statutory violations are not the same as constitutional violations.
Absolutely.
Just because you don't follow a state law to the letter,
right,
doesn't automatically mean evidence gets thrown out.
You generally need either a constitutional violation or proof that the police were intentionally trying to violate someone's rights to get evidence suppressed.
So it's a much higher bar.
Way higher.
Okay, so we've got Lyons where intent extends liability even to unintended victims. Mm-hmm. And this Massachusetts case where lack of bad intent on the part of the police is a big reason why the evidence is allowed.
So in both cases, intent is crucial. but it plays out in totally different ways.
Right. In the lions, the focus is on the defendant's state of mind.
Yeah. What were they thinking when they acted?
And how that connects to what actually happened, even if it wasn't the exact plan.
It's about holding people responsible based on that initial intent.
Even if the outcome wasn't what they were aiming for.
Right. And in the Massachusetts case, the focus shifts to the cops. What were they thinking?
Did they screw up on purpose, or was it an honest mistake?
Yeah. And if there's no sign of malice, that limits the use of the exclusionary rule.
So intent is at the heart of both cases, but its presence or absence has very different legal consequences.
Fascinating. Right.
It is. And you know what else strikes me?
What's that?
It seems like both cases also hinge on this idea of legislative purpose.
Okay. I see what you're getting at.
So in Lyon's letting in, that evidence of past behavior was seen as important for making sure the trial was fair.
Right. The jury needs to understand the full picture of the defendant's mental state.
Exactly. And in the Massachusetts case, the court decided that the whole point of that pre-complaint hearing law wasn't to automatically toss out reliable evidence.
Especially not in a different investigation where no one's constitutional rights were harmed.
Right. So they're looking at the intent behind the laws themselves.
Absolutely. Courts often try to figure out what lawmakers were trying to achieve with both criminal laws and these procedural rules.
And that helps them decide how to apply those laws in specific cases.
It's all about context.
So for anyone listening who's wrestling with criminal law, here's the takeaway.
A big one.
Figure out what kind of violation you're dealing with.
Is it a core constitutional right that's been violated?
Or is it just a procedural misstep?
Right.
A state law that wasn't followed perfectly?
Because the legal remedies and whether evidence can be excluded will be totally different depending on the answer.
Always make that distinction between constitutional rights and statutory rules.
It's fundamental.
Well, this has been a great deep dive into criminal law.
Yeah, we've covered a lot of ground.
We've seen how intent can really expand criminal liability, like in Lyons.
Yeah, and how the absence of bad intent from the police can affect whether evidence is suppressed.
Especially when we're talking about those statutory violations.
It all highlights how the law tries to balance the substance of criminal behavior.
The intent behind the actions.
With the processes of how we gather and present evidence in court.
So here's a final thought to ponder.
I like where this is going.
What kinds of arguments could a defense attorney make when they're dealing with a case where a procedural mistake maybe also led to a violation of a broader constitutional principle?
Whoa. Yeah, that's getting really nuanced.
Right, like maybe that constitutional issue isn't immediately obvious.
That's where a skilled defense attorney can really make a difference.
Exactly. It's that intersection of intent, procedure, and constitutional rights.
A lot to think about.
Definitely something to keep in mind as you keep exploring these areas of the law.
You've given us a lot to chew on, for sure.
All right, until next time, keep diving deep.
And always question everything.